Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our senior online entertainment editor. That's quite a mouthful, Jack Shepherd.
Yeah, it is a mouthful. Hello.
He's had a promotion, ladies and gentlemen. And one of our contributing editors, Neil Smith.
Hello.
Hello. So this week we are weighing up Kenneth Branagh's Christie mystery, Death on the Nile, J-Lo's rom-com Marry Me, Oscar-nominated Flea, and Tom Holland's swing to adventurer Uncharted. But before we get onto them, there's been some news in the film world, hasn't there? The Oscars have been announced. What do we think about that? Any glaring omissions, Neil?
The one that's, I suppose, a lot of people have been making fuss over is Lady Gaga from the Best Actress. But the Best Actress category is a very strong one, so I'm not surprised she couldn't get in there. There's also no room for Elaine Haim, who got a BAFTA nomination for Licorice Pizza, and an outside bet for Jennifer Hudson, of course. You've got Olivia Colman, you've got Nicole Kidman, Jessica Chastain, Kristen Stewart, and Penelope Cruz. A very strong lineup. So I'm not really surprised that as good as Lady Gaga it was in the House of Gucci, she didn't agree to make it into that lineup.
But her hair and makeup they've got a nomination, haven't they? Or is it costume? Can't quite remember. Something of the Fabulousness has been nominated, but only one nom for that film. So clearly the Academy were not that keen on it, despite everyone's best efforts. Jack, what did you make of the announcements yesterday?
Other than the obvious snub for Jared Leto in House of Gucci as well, you know,
he worthy? Is Sashika? Was that Oscar worthy? Come on now.
I have a lot of time for it. I mean, he got the Razzie, so it's fine. I would probably say, well, it depends how you're going to say his name. Is it Denuvi? There were many, many pronunciations in the announcement.
Yes. But old Kieran Hines was Kareen Hines.
Oh, it's just not great. But yeah, Denny for in the Best Director category. I mean, Dune got 10 nominations in total, but he missed out, which, you know, is a massive shot in the leg for any chance it has at Best Picture now.
Argo was Best Picture and Ben Affleck wasn't director, didn't get director, but I don't know.
That's a real rarity, isn't it? That's like, you know, we're fighting an uphill battle now.
It's so weird that film that is so much about a person's vision and a will to bring a sort of film that to the screen, a book to the screen that, you know, David Lynch had failed to do. It's entirely a director's vision. How on earth could it get all of those nominations and not for the person who literally marshaled that to the screen? It's kind of weird, isn't it?
Steven Spielberg kind of took his place. That was the final battle there. And, you know, you're going up against one of the most iconic directors of all time. It's going to be a difficult one. So you can't complain too much, but at the same time, he was robbed and I feel deeply sorry for him. And I think he definitely should have been there.
He's got another chance though, because he's making part two. So maybe they'll reward him for that.
Yeah. Maybe it'll be like Lord of the Rings, where suddenly, like with the last part, they're like, oh yeah, no, this is a big deal. We should definitely award it with the last one.
What about Best Actor, Neil? What do you think about that? Big Willie's in there. Getting jiggy
with it. Well, I think you've got the two heavy hitters, which are Will Smith for King Richard and Benedict Cumberbatch for The Power of the Dog. It's really a head-to-head between them. Much as I liked Andrew Garfield in Tick, Tick, Boom, Denzel Washington and The Tragedy of Macbeth. Curious choice there, but not really. The real curious one is Javier Bardem for Being the Ricardos. A real surprise. And I think that he probably took a place that might have gone to Leonardo DiCaprio for Don't Look Up. But maybe they just thought that they couldn't, nominate Nicole Kidman without nominating him, which is a strange decision, but that's the decision they've come up with.
It does mean that the Cruise Bardem family are having quite the outing on Oscar night, doesn't it? Both Mr. and Mrs. nominated. They might both go home with a gong.
And indeed, as are the Kirsten Dunst and Jesse Plemons yes. family, both nominated there. Two of the four acting nominations that The Power of the Dog has got, which was why they've got the most nominations of all with 12.
We will see how it all comes out in the wash and who's going to be presenting, because we still don't know that. But yeah, let's see. Have you been watching anything else, you guys? Jack, have you been watching anything else that's caught your eye this week?
I've just finished the Boba Fett finale. Mm. So no spoilers. I don't really know what to say about it. It's quite a lot. It's like an hour long. I can say that I am whelmed.
Whelmed.
And that's about it. There are no strong feelings either way, really, at the moment. It's still settling in. but don't get too excited. I really loved the last few episodes. I thought when it kind of went all out Mandalorian, that's been really, really fun. And now it's, yeah, it wraps in an odd way. I will say nothing more. Yeah, that's been my, I mean, I want to go back and tackle all the Star Wars movies again, just because it's given me a real Star Wars itch. But then we're going to get Obi-Wan Kenobi in.
Yes, it's incoming.
Like 3 months. So I can wait until then.
You can. Just calm down. Neil, what have you been watching?
I'm watching the first half of the final fourth season of Ozark, which I'm enjoying a great deal. It's kind of Breaking Bad light. I'm fully accepting of that, but I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying the acting and just the contortions that they managed to continue with this story of this sort of normal family kind of sucked into a criminal underworld. And Julia Garner is terrific in it. We were certainly going to see her in the Inventing Anna Netflix series. And I understand that she's been linked to the Madonna biopic, playing the young Madonna in that film. So, she's fantastic to watch and everything.
Mm. I watched the last episode of And Just Like That, a sort of hate watch for me, which I find astonishingly like not connected to real life. Obviously not. I mean, the things that people wear and go out to lunch with and go to spread ashes in Paris wearing. But, you know, just like this craziness, we're doing this podcast and it ended with somebody who was on a podcast having to quit their podcast because they were moving across the country. Do they know Zoom exists? Anyway, so that was my thing. But anyway, I was just like, I need to give this person a call. Like, I think you probably could keep that job. I think it's okay. I think you could do both. You could probably work around those schedules and those digital things might help. Anyway, shall we move on? Shall we get into a glossy, glossy thing? It's time to gather in one room, mon ami, and reveal whether this is any good or not.
It's too late to change events. It's time to face the consequence.
Someone is dead. The crime is murder.
Never again is what
the murderer is one of you.
Were you aware of any grudges?
Madame is used to getting what she wants.
Never again is what she.
I don't feel safe here. I don't feel safe with any of them.
So this is Death on the Nile, Kenneth Branagh's other film, not the one that's been nominated in all the awards bodies. Neil, what's this one about?
Well, it has been quite a week for Kenneth Branagh, you know, with the nominations he's received for Belfast, making him he's now been nominated for 8 Oscars in 7 categories, yet to win one. Comes the other side of his oeuvre, which is reprising his performance as Hercule Poirot in the second big screen adaptation of the Agatha Christie novel from 1937, famously filmed before, of course. In 1978 with Peter Ustinov and an all-star cast, including Mia Farrow, Bette Davis, Maggie Smith. Kenneth Branagh has assembled his own stellar cast, I'm not going to quite say all-star cast, for the reprise of what is a very traditional whodunit set on a paddle steamer going down the Nile. Effectively, it's a wedding party that Hercule Poirot has been invited to, and along the way, so one of the people on the steamer gets mysteriously bumped off, and of course it's up to him to find out who done it.
And everybody has a reason. So Jack, let's tick off some of the folk that are in this. We've got Gal Gadot, we've got Armie Hammer, we've got Sophie Okonedo. Who else? Come on.
Letitia Wright, Dawn French, Russell Brand, Annette Bening, Tom Bateman. You've got
Emma McKay.
Loads and loads of people all come together for this whodunit. What did you think, Jane? I know you wrote the review, so I kind of have an idea of what you thought, but I want to know your visceral reaction to that.
So I gave this a 3. And when I say 3, that seems quite generous from what I think we're about to say about this film. But I would say that a 3 is one of those lovely star ratings that you can be at the low end of. It's not a 2, but it's not a 3 high, nudging 4. It's one of those films. It's a bit of a mess, isn't it? The CGI going on here that is mind-blowing that someone would, in a day and age of really good CGI, put a film out with such dodgy pyramids and snakes and a weird crocodile and a little fishy and various other things. The original, I loved the original. And it was all filmed on location in Egypt, and it was sweaty, and you could see the antiquities. And when they were actually looking at pyramids, they were at pyramids. This film was made before the pandemic, so there's no excuse that they didn't travel there. And they decided to film it all on location in Longcross Studios in Buckinghamshire. And the ship is amazing because that was built at the studio full scale. Amazing. Feels very real. Nothing else does, including the performances. We've had the Gal Gadot, you know, enough champagne to fill the Nile has gone a bit viral. And that's the level we're dealing with, isn't it? It's very silly here. I mean, I was thinking with great delight after the screening that I saw about, you know, Armie Hammer's cry face, Gal Gadot and him sort of dry humping against an antiquity, you know, a man flying a fake kite on a fake pyramid, the way that Branagh said vegetable, all sorts of delights in this that are actually quite entertaining. Did you not think, or was it terrible for you? Because people have hated this as well.
It definitely made a difference seeing it with, I was at a big screening at the Odeon Leicester Square, and there were some people absolutely cackling along with it, like at bits that I'm not sure were meant to be funny.
I don't and think everyone... much of it was supposed to be funny.
No, but you kind of lulled into it because it's just so silly. Like there are, it's really hard to kind of put a way of describing it somehow. I found it really hard to put a finger on it, but there's something about it, that the melodrama of it all, that is just kind of shot in this very odd way. I mean, there's some great use of like refracturing light through glass and seeing, you know, people on screen, the basically using the physical set that's there in a very interesting way. But the backgrounds are so shonky, the like Egyptian look of it just does not work. And then you've got these kind of everyone doing these accents all over the place. I mean, I have a lot of time for Kenneth's Hercule Poirot. I think he's really, really fun in the role. I don't think we needed an origin story for his mustache, but you know, each to their own. Sure. I also quite like how Kenneth's kind of done this. He does like a black and white intro to this, and then the movie goes into color. And then with Belfast, he did the color intro into the black and white movie. I like
that. Just keeping it consistent.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a worry. And I saw someone tweet that, what if Death in the Nile means that he shot himself in the foot for the Oscar for best director? Because I mean, I really, really love Belfast. And I thought this was like a fun mess. Like, it takes a long time until the first murder happens.
An hour.
That's not really.
It's at least an hour.
And I, you know, you're there wondering, what am I paying for? I wanted to see, you know, death and everyone eyeing each other up. I mean, they set the scene, but it does take an awful long time to get to the point where Poirot's like properly investigating it. And that's where the movie takes off for me, when he's kind of doing his interrogations and everyone's kind of like, are they lying? Are they not? That's the fun side of it. And so the fact that it takes so long to get there, I just kind of got a little bit bored. And then it wrote me back in. And then the ending, there's the denouement where it's revealed what happened and it's supposed to be really serious and there's no music and it's really, you know, it's all silent. But then there were just people in the cinema going like, like laughing at it. And I was like, oh man, this is so like, I don't know what I'm supposed to be feeling right now. That's a word splurge.
Thank you for your therapy session, Jack. That was lovely. Neil, what did you think?
Yeah, by far the weirdest element is, as Jack says, this moustache backstory. Obviously, the moustache was by far the most divisive element from the first Christie adaptation he did, Murder on the Orient Express. So now he has decided to give it, it's very emotional and detailed and almost tragic backstory. The weirdest thing, other than that, is just when you, it's very hard to divorce the film from its offstage shenanigans. Armie Hammer has obviously been cancelled since he shot his contribution to the film. Letitia Wright made some controversy with her post about vaccines. Weirdly, Gal Gadot appears in this movie dressed up as Cleopatra, and she's getting an awful lot of heat for wanting to make a real version of Cleopatra. And then you have Russell Brand and French and Saunders in very straight non-comedic roles, which is just odd as well. actress I did enjoy, and I thought Emma Mackey makes a really good contribution. She made her presence as the sort of spurned woman is, I think, more kind of passion and energy than the rest of the film put together. And it's a great kind of vehicle for her, for the actress, which we've previously just seen in Sex Education. But generally, I just don't think it works. And Kenneth Branagh would love to think that this is setting up a whole new franchise, and he's got a lot of Hercule Poirot films in him, but I think he's in denial.
Oh, Neil, Bvumtish, very good. Is it going to cost him, you know, awards? Don't you think it might actually do the reverse, that you're like, oh, he can make that, but, you know, he can make something much better with Belfast? It could go the other way, couldn't it? I mean, are the Academy going to, you know, penalise him for making something frothy? And we should bear in mind that Murder on the Orient Express made a mint. You never know, people might flock to the cinema to see this one, and it might make a lot of money, which is also important in Hollywood.
I just don't know. I don't know if it feels like a cinema movie. I would have definitely watched this on Disney Plus, and I think it should. It feels like the sort of movie that should have just been put out in the pandemic for us to enjoy a year ago, rather than necessarily being held back for the cinema. I mean, obviously, we have such a rich history of like whodunits in the UK with Midsummer Murders and stuff like that. And it kind of feels
rich
just like
history,
one of
Midsummer Murders. That's where you go with that.
Listen, okay, we all love Midsummer Murders.
Miss Marple,
that's how it
come
is.
On.
But it feels like an ITV kind of, like, I would watch that on an ITV on ITV on a Sunday, and French and Saunders and Russell Brand would be there, and you would be like, you've got a bit of, like, you know, English royalty there. You don't need Annette Bening in the role she's in doing, like, this strange accent. So
apparently that's an English accent she's attempting there.
Well, I didn't want to put a name on it, but yeah, I think that's what she is going for. But it all gives it this kind of slightly cheaper feel to it. And then, you know, they spent all the budget on having Gal Gadot in this huge golden dress for no reason. That was there's a really strange scene where she's just kind of standing
dressed
there
up. Yeah.
as Cleopatra. And it just doesn't make any sense.
No. The other thing about the whole French and Saunders thing and Russell Brand is that you could imagine that this was a French and Saunders elongated sketch, couldn't you? Like, it teeters on that sort of French and Saunders when they do pastiches of TV programs. You know, when they used to do House of Elliot, it's sort of a bit like that. But isn't there not just fun in that? Is there not fun in going to see a film that you kind of know is ridiculous in the first place and you'll enjoy it, Neil?
If you enjoy Agatha Christie adaptations, you will enjoy this. I think it has everything you'd expect, minus maybe a little bit of verve and energy. But really, if you want to ask who done it, you have to look to Rian Johnson done it. He done it in Knives Out. He kind of took this formula and gave it a real kick in the pants. And this really sort of, if anything, is a regression. It's a retranchement, as Poirot might say, and it doesn't do enough with the formula and the genre to kind of really give it a reason to exist. Unlike, of course, The Moustache, which has its own raison d'etre in the film, far more maybe than the film does.
So I think we're saying go and see it with lowered expectations. Is that right?
Yes, I think that's
fair. It's better than Murder on the Orient Express, isn't it? And I did have fun seeing it. I know I've been quite critical, but it's that kind of like high, silly fun that you can have in a cinema, and seeing it with a big group of people was fun. I mean, everyone was having glasses of red wine. Everyone was, you know, there are really fun moments in the film. So as harsh as I can be on it and think it's just a very odd movie, but also very fun. And if you're into, if you like, enjoyed Murder on the Orient Express, then yeah, you'll definitely enjoy this one.
Also, don't go hungry, because Poirot does eat delicious puddings all the way through it, and is constantly, you know, never knowingly without a tiny pudding to hand. So, yeah, do take something sweet with you if you're going. So that is Death on the Nile, and it's out in cinemas this Friday. Right, next up, possibly in the same vein, who knows, is it a yes or a no on this?
All right, let's do it again from the top. Marry me, say yes.
The Marry Me Concert Tour is something you will not want to miss. In 36 hours, superstar Kat Valdez and Grammy-winning Bastion will perform their new song, Marry Me, and exchange vows in front of a streaming audience of 20 million people.
See you tomorrow. I'll be the one in the veil.
This is Marry Me, Jennifer Lopez's new rom-com, where she plays a sort of similar version to herself, who gets into a sticky situation on stage and ends up marrying Owen Wilson. Neil, tell us how that happens.
Jennifer Lopez plays Kat Valdez, who is very much like a Jennifer Lopez figure in this adventure world, and as well as being a chart-topping superstar and presumably TV celebrity, she's one half of this power couple with a musical star called Bastion, who's played by a real-life musician from Illuma. The idea is that they're going to have a fabulous, glitzy wedding on stage at her gig at New York's Madison Square Garden. And seconds before they're about to exchange vows, she finds out that he's been cheating on her. So rather than marrying him, she looks out into the audience and picks randomly a high school math teacher, Charlie Gilbert, played by Owen Wilson, who, for reasons I can't begin to explain, is carrying a sign saying, marry me. And also for reasons I can't explain, he goes along with this. He goes on stage and he ties the knot with her. And it's the strangest kind of meet-cute that I've seen in rom-com for a while. And what happens the rest of the movie is we find out whether they are actually compatible, and in this kind of Notting Hill way, whether celebrity can find love with a normal guy.
Yes, it's very Notting Hill, isn't it? I mean, that's very much the sort of groove of this whole thing. But it's also hugely sort of, it works or it doesn't work on the charisma and the sort of likability of the leads. And to that, I think, you know, both of them are just so, you know, they're so charming and they give it their all. They're just selling the hell out of this. So for me, I kind of went with it and I was like, okay, of course he wouldn't just say, yeah, I'll marry a random woman, and she wouldn't pick him, the man with the windbreaker, as he's described, out of the crowd. But I kind of allowed it to happen because I do think Jennifer Lopez is incredibly magnetic and, you know, fabulous on screen. And this is just her dressed up in all of those outfits, all the glitter, all the gowns, you know, the false eyelashes are just like huge. Everything is just extra. So this is just a confection for the eyes, isn't it? Or did it just not do it for you, Neil?
Yeah, I thought it was going to be the wedding I was being desperate to leave. I actually kind of went with it. I thought it was just sort of, I mean, it embraced its silliness. It sort of just went with it. It said, you know, we know this is a ridiculous scenario, but just go with it and we'll kind of pay you off. You know, you'll get a nice sort of, you'll get a nice slice of cake and, you know, a twirl around the dance floor. And we'll kind of send you away happy. And I think that it generally does. It's certainly not, intellectually stimulating. You can pick it apart all you like. Some of the songs that Kat Brothers sings are so kind of right. She does this whole number about how love is like church and things, wearing this kind of crucifix outfit. I think with dancing nuns and PVC around, I'm thinking, are we supposed to take this seriously, or is this genuinely a superstar in this universe on J-Lo's kind of level? But if you kind of go with the cheesiness, then you can certainly enjoy. I mean, the gowns are fantastic. The wedding gown is amazing. She turns up in this golden confection, which knocks Gal Gadot's Cleopatra into a cocked hat. And Owen Wilson is just pure kind of like, you know, befuddled charm as this high school math teacher who's more worried about pie than he is about wedding cake. But generally, I think if you go with it, you'll have a good time.
It also feels a bit knowing, doesn't it, as well? I mean, you know, Lopez, this is very much a caricature of her real life. You know, she talks about having been married before and not choosing the right guy and looking for love a second time around, and the fact that nobody ever nominates her for an award, but that she's incredibly successful and has, you know, huge deals with blenders and whatever else, and she's incredibly successful. There's also two very obvious pointers to Coach, the handbag company that she is a real life ambassador for. So it really feels like this is Jennifer Lopez saying, this is a version of my life. This is a silly, very heightened, arch version of my life. And I understand that you draw parallels between my real life and, you know, the photo shoots with Ben Affleck and the marriages and then the getting back with your old flame and the Coach endorsement and everything else. And I understand you as an audience will draw those parallels, and I'm leaning into that. And so I kind of really warmed to that as well, that she knows, she's totally self-aware, and this is a very self-aware film, but that also we don't get a rom-com very often, like a proper, true, cheesy not realistic at all. People running across country and getting planes to stop someone and tell them that you love them. We don't get them very often. And this is very much in that vein. And I realized I kind of enjoy those. I didn't realize I'd missed them, but I do kind of enjoy that. Jack, do you think you'd fancy this?
Yeah, so I haven't seen this one, but I am supposed to be seeing it tomorrow and I will be taking my partner. I'm looking forward to watching a proper rom-com because it has been so long since we've seen one in the cinema. I also have so many questions now about this film because, like, is Owen Wilson just at this concert on his own with this sign?
And no, like, because that would be weird.
Okay.
He has a young, I mean, there's this other sort of subplot, which is he's a single parent to a young girl who's just starting high school. And then, you know, Kat is instrumental in helping this girl find her way through high school socially, but also embrace the geek in herself and, you know, find confidence. And so there's that sort of little subplot. So there's also Sarah Silverman, who we should mention, who is a colleague of Owen Wilson at the school, who's sort of in there as with the zingy sort of one-liners and, you know, pepping stuff up in the background. She's very good, very enjoyable to watch as well. And there's also the other thing that's kind of interesting to watch is usually in these films when somebody's playing a pop star, there's a hideous manager who doesn't want anything good to happen to their client and is just only after the money. And in this one, actually, the manager is one of the, you know, chief cheerleaders for Kat and is very caring and is ready with a hug and is just trying to help her figure out the best way through life. Thought that was kind of refreshing.
He's played by John Bradley, who we saw last week in Moonfall, who's having this sort of interesting sort of movie career off the back of Game of Thrones. The one thing I was a little worried for is that Owen Wilson has an ailing dog. And I was thinking, oh, no, Marley and Me Too. Is it going to be sort of one wedding and a funeral saying goodbye to the dog at the end of the movie? But luckily, without giving too much away, it isn't Marley and Me Too. So
yeah, Tank does make it. He doesn't go for many walks, but he's alive at the end, which is a relief.
My question is Owen Wilson or J-Lo like the main character? Because in Notting Hill, obviously, it's like Hugh Grant as like the main guy. Or do they like share screen time? Or is there like, is it like his story and he's falling in love with
the
celeb?
Why would you even question that? The queen, J-Lo, is the star. And that's fully evident by every single high-heeled shoe and billowing blouse she wears. No question. Next.
Like, I'm intrigued to see a movie which puts the like famous person as the kind of main person, like falling in love and like having to like hang out with the normie, you know. Oh, we're just people too. I'm excited for that. I think I'll enjoy it. I hope, maybe we'll see.
I think we would suggest that everybody goes and enjoys this if you like a rom-com. If you like Notting Hill, then this is really a modern update of it. So I think it's going to warm your cockles. So that, if you fancy that, is Marry Me, and it is out in cinemas on Friday. Okay, it's time for plane talking, which is where we demystify things that are said on film sets and in movies. This week, we're talking about first ADs. What is a first AD? Jack?
First assistant director.
And what do they do?
Well, the first AD started out in the early days of cinema. It's almost like a shadow to the director. It was somebody who would follow his every move and be like a sort of on-set factotum and do everything that the director needed him to. And through that, we have a career as a director himself. Both Alfred Hitchcock and Akira Kurosawa started as assistant directors. But over the years, it's evolved into a more of a logistical and managerial position. So the first AD is the person who prepares the call sheets in the morning, keeps the film on schedule, takes care of health and safety, make sure that everybody is where they're supposed to be. So now it's much more of a position with its own kind of roles, and obviously you have like third assistant directors becoming second assistant directors, becoming first ADs, and that in itself is considered a position rather than having any directorial ambitions beyond that. So yeah, it's basically the guy who knows what's going on the set.
Or girl,
you're right, Jane. Or girl.
Absolutely. Anyone can be a first AD. Okay, so shall we move on then? It's time for an Oscar-nominated film now. So probably, you know, Marry Me and Death on the Nile won't be troubling Oscars anytime soon. It's this.
The girl want and think to be. So det min fortid, og det jeg ikke flygte for det. Jeg har ikke lyst.
So this is Flea. Tell us about this one, Jack.
So Flea's a documentary about a man called Amin Nawabi, who is a Afghani refugee living in Denmark with his partner. And the story is about this documentary maker, Jonas Poer Rasmussen, from Denmark, who interviews Amin. And Amin kind of reveals his story, his journey from Afghanistan to Denmark. But it's all animated. It's filmed, though the film itself is kind of covered over in animation. And this is to hide people's identities. Like Amin, that's not his real name. We don't know his true identity. And it's to keep him safe. So his story as a child starts back in the 80s in Afghanistan. And it's through the Russian Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan, the troops being withdrawn, and his family then leave the country and flee the country to get to Russia. And then it's their journey from there and his family all scattered around Europe. And yeah, it's a very moving story about refugees and having to leave a country that's war-torn. I found it very emotional and thought it was excellently done and very unique in its animation style as well. Neil, what did you think?
It's a really powerful piece of filmmaking. No coincidence that it's picked up Oscar nominations for animated feature, documentary feature, and international feature, which is the first time any film's ever been nominated for all three of those awards. Like you say, it takes you into the sort of the refugee experience. It takes you into the sort of the hardships and the penury and the dislocation of being a literally a stranger in a strange land. And but what it really does is it shows that the lead character of isn't just a refugee. You know, he's a talented individual. He's got dreams, he's got hopes, he's got a long-term boyfriend he's hoping to marry, and it just shows that behind every statistic there's a story, and in this case it's a really kind of moving and heart-rending one.
I do think the way it deals with Amin's sexuality is very interesting, because I hadn't really, you just forget how, I guess, easygoing it's still very difficult to be even out in the West. But then when you're in a country like Afghanistan, and he says, and he makes a point of saying that there's no word for homosexuality there because it just doesn't exist. And then we see him struggle with it and even asking a doctor at one stage whether they can cure him of that. It's just so devastating. And Neil's very right in saying it's a very human story. We see all these huge numbers, and then you think that every single one of them, though, you know, those people has gone through an ordeal like this. I mean, we see there's one time when they go out with some traffickers, and then the whole ordeal is just, it leads to nothing, and they're back in square one again. And I found it very heavy and thought provoking, and just made me want to try and help in some way. And I think it's an important movie in that way, and hopefully it can make some sort of difference. And having the exposure of being nominated for you know, quite a few Oscars, hopefully it just gets seen by more people, and therefore, you know, if you can see it on a big screen, you know, the animation is fantastic and really helps kind of add to the story. It really helps portray the events he went through as well, because obviously normally if it's just a man talking to the camera, you don't get to see the journey, and actually having the camera kind of go on that journey and into, you know, freighters of people being transported. Yeah, very visceral, very moving, and unlike, you know, any documentaries that I've seen before. So yeah, highly recommend from me.
Yeah, it sounds like this is an important film, not only sort of culturally and artistically in both of those ways. It's also produced by Riz Ahmed, who's on a roll at the moment. So this is another one of the polygoth Riz Ahmed's output, and he's been making amazing films to really highlight the experience of immigrants and people having to make that journey. So I can't wait to see it. So that is Flea, and that is out in cinemas on Friday. Okay, it's time for alternative line reading now. And this, as usual, is somebody we've talked about on this podcast in another film. I think I'll do this in the style of Gal Gadot and her approach to acting in Death on the Nile. Anyone can own one nice suit. You want to look at their shoes, their watches, their briefcases, their wedding rings. Always look for a wedding ring. And once you get them on the hook, that's when we get the net. I had the champagne glass in my hand while saying that.
Do you know what that is?
You know, I have to say that even though the Gal Gadotness was very apparent, I did detect just a little bit of J-Lo in those words. I think we're talking about her advice to her fellow hustlers, how to get men's credit cards and their credit card details. So yes, it's hustlers, isn't it?
It is. And it sounds like this, which is far, far better than my Gal Gadot.
Like anyone can own one nice suit. You want to look at their shoes, their watches, briefcases, their wedding rings. Always look for a wedding ring.
Jimmy, where's Ron Moran?
Once you got him on the hook, that's when we get the net.
So time to move on then. Get your boots on, lads. It's adventure time with this.
Hey, kid. A little young for a bartender, aren't you?
A little old for prom, aren't you?
Everything in here. Why the map?
It's the biggest treasure that's never been found.
5 billion easy.
But it's just a story.
I beg to differ.
Years ago, my family found the world's biggest fortune, then was betrayed. People have been searching for it all in vain.
Both of you turn your keys clockwise at the same time.
Thanks a lot. You almost got me killed.
Why, Sully?
Well, it was 50-50, so I made a guess.
Clearly.
So that's Uncharted, Tom Holland's foray into action adventure based on a video game. They don't have a great deal of luck in the cinema, do they? Jack, tell us about this.
Tom Holland plays the swashbuckling Nathan Drake, known as Nate, who in this film is kind of an origin story for the game for anyone who's played them. It happens quite a bit before. He's a lot younger than the version of Nate who's in the games. We meet him as a child at the very beginning, and then we gradually see him as a bartender who hopes for more. He's like a cheeky bartender who steals someone's bracelet.
And doesn't then sound like a bartender I'd enjoy.
No. And he's spotted by Mark Wahlberg's Sully, who has a connection with Tom's Nate, having known Nate's brother, Sam. And the two of them, they decide that they're going to go get this long-lost treasure, and they need these two golden keys, and then it kind of takes off from there and they travel around the world. And I didn't mind this movie. Did I mean it was,
is that faint praise I can hear there?
It was faint, very faint praise. I'd love to know Neil's thoughts and then I'll go in.
I wasn't familiar with the game. So for me, it felt like kind of Larry Croft Doubloon Raider. In the way that it was.
Oh, very well done, Neil.
Effectively, this dashing sort of adventurer in who aspires to be Indiana Jones, but really the level is more on kind of National Treasure with a bit of kind of Da Vinci Code style product solving on the route to the kind of outlandish action finale. Yeah, I guess it's entertaining enough. I just didn't feel there was enough there, really. And I think it kind of hangs on Tom Holland's aspirations to be more than Spider-Man as kind of leading man. And in this particular film, I didn't find him as charming as I do in the Spider-Man films. I thought he was a little bit too cocky, a little bit too ahead of himself. And the weird thing is it begins with a flashback showing a young Tom Holland, which I feel is a contradiction in terms. He looks like he's 14, and yet they have an actor playing like the young Tom Holland before he becomes the Tom Holland we know as the bartender, who apparently only makes cocktails out of absolute vodka, from what I could see. I mean, the most outrageous product placement in his bar, which has the weird title, Kitty Get Wet. Jane, would you like to go have an absolute cocktail in Kitty Get Wet, the New York's happening nightclub?
It feels a sexual type thing, doesn't it? And a bit grubby. But, you know, I do enjoy a vodka martini, so perhaps I would. But what I wouldn't want is to have my barman stealing off me. So that would put me off. Also, he doesn't even look 21 himself. So I wonder how he does in a New York bar. But anyway, Jack, this is, you know, has aspirations to start a franchise. Is it going to?
It very much sets up a franchise at the end. It has post-credit scenes and all that. My main problem, and it's very much like Neil's, is Tom Holland in this role. It doesn't really suit him. It doesn't feel like, I don't necessarily want to see much more of this version of this character. I mean, I was quite actually surprised by Mark Wahlberg in this, because I found myself really enjoying his performance and really enjoying him and wishing that he was the lead character, because they kind of play it as this buddy cop movie between the two of them, this, you know, the young guy and his mentor, but Nathan isn't naive enough to necessarily need a mentor that much. So they're supposed to kind of be on a level, but they're also not. And it's a very strange dynamic, and it's fun when it gets going and there are some fun quips between the two of them. But I just wanted it to focus either on Mark Wahlberg's version of this character or Tom Holland's version of his character. And it just feels a bit messy. You also have this other character called Chloe Fraser who's introduced, and there is this very interesting Australian accent. We've spoken a lot about accents on this podcast now. But yeah, I think it's supposed to be Australian. It dips into New Zealand. It dips into kind of British. Yeah, it's not the best.
Let's talk about Antonio Banderas, though. You know, like, I love him in pretty much everything. He's shown, you know, he's a great actor, you know, in Almodovar. He's amazing. He's fantastic in Puss in Boots. No one can take that away from him. Is he bringing it here?
He was a highlight of the film, I think, because even though he's not in it a great deal, he just picks it up to another level. And he brings in a bit of kind of a class and a bit of sophistication, a bit of menace. His voice is just terrific, you know. Without giving too much away, I just wish that he had more to do in this particular film rather than sort of glower menacingly and on from the sidelines.
He was probably the best thing in The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard too, cruising around in his Lux wear and sort of being a baddie. I enjoy Antonio Banderas as a heightened baddie. He should do more of it. He's great.
There was a line which he was referred to as, oh, going over there and talk to your arch nemesis. So, yeah, I mean, that's great. He's basically the arch nemesis in this movie. And with what he has, he does quite well with it.
But not enough of him. And is there enough action? I mean, one of the things that this game is famous for is its sort of action sequences. And, you know, we see in the trailer that Nate is hanging out the back of a cargo plane and there's all sorts of shenanigans with great galleons being lifted out of beaches and whatnot. Is that exciting, or it's just the Tom Holland thing too hard to get over?
I think when you look beyond some of the CGI, there are some fun action set pieces in this. I really enjoyed the last third with the flying ships, as we've seen in the trailers. That's a really, really fun set piece. There's a lot going on with it, but it's shot really well. You're at a point in the movie where you've got the camaraderie between Mark Wahlberg's character and Tom Holland's character kind of really working. It all comes together for this really excellent, like, 20-25 minutes. It's just getting there that's a slight slog, and some of the earlier action set pieces feel slightly tedious or unnecessary. I mean, that one which you were talking about with the hanging out the back of the cargo plane, that is at the very beginning of the movie. And then it's also in the middle of the movie again, and they revisit it from a slightly different angle. And it just feels slightly, it felt unnecessary to me.
Well, the whole cargo sequence is a complete ripoff of The Living Daylights, which I felt did it much better and realer in a way, because obviously the CGI is very apparent in the film. I did quite like the whole airborne galleon sequence. It had a bit of Captain Blood, Pirates of the Caribbean element to it, which is quite fun. I think the action is okay, but it doesn't kind of pitch it to the level it really wants to be. But I think fans will like it. I think there's a bit of fan service. I sensed a bit of ripple of delight when Tom Holland put on a holster. I presume that's part of Nathan Drake's kind of, like, you know, MO, the way he kind of puts it on. Everyone seemed quite appreciative of that. And there was a cameo from an actor called Nolan North, who I understand is the voice actor from the Uncharted games. So people will appreciate that if they're familiar with the games. But I don't think there's enough to bring new fans into this particular world.
So is it a good time at the cinema? I mean, are you going to get your value for money if you just want a good time out?
Jack, what do you think?
Neil, passing the buck.
I find this movie quite difficult to talk about because I did the cover feature for a Toll film and had a great time speaking to the cast, especially Tom Holland, who I think is a really lovely bloke and seemed and was very passionate about this project. And I've also played the games as well. I feel like I'm quite invested in Uncharted, and I came away quite disappointed, I think, because I did want more from it. And I think for anyone who has enjoyed the games and stuff, it's just, it's a different beast. It's a different thing. Like, there's still some of the familiar quips and stuff, but the relationships in the movie, the characters are very different. And so it's interesting from that perspective. If I was a new person who didn't know any of this and just seen Tom Holland in Spider-Man and wanted to see this, I think I would be also probably just slightly disappointed, because I don't think he quite gets into the character enough. I don't think he feels comfortable enough as this slightly smirking, quipping character, and it's hard to kind of look beyond him being Spider-Man, especially with Spider-Man so big in cinemas right now. So I'm slightly mixed on it. There are some really fun action sequences. I also think that this could also have the Venom effect, where I was not the biggest fan of the first Venom movie, but everyone seemed to love it.
Other people were, yeah.
Yeah.
Could just so be you grumpy could... person.
Apparently, yeah.
I mean, Tom Holland has spoken about his anxiety about this role and taking it on, and his sort of the fact that he wasn't convinced himself, and he felt that he wasn't certain he was right for it as well. And maybe we're seeing a bit of that in his performance. But in terms of being a star, he's an absolute star in the Spider-Man role. Does this show that, you know, we want to see more of him on screen? Perhaps not in this role, but we do want to see more of Tom Holland. He has the ability to hold an audience's attention. What do you reckon, Neil?
I think there is a great post-Spider-Man role waiting for Tom Holland, but I don't think this is necessarily it. Maybe this is maybe just a kind of like a step on the way to him finding it. And maybe the next one, he should basically go out alone. I feel, you know, they've paired him with... Mark Wahlberg, as one of my colleagues said, Holland and Wahlberg sounds like more like a pair of solicitors than action movie heroes. But so in a way, they're sort of like easing him by giving him a kind of like someone who's an old hand at this kind of thing, sort of to riff off. But I think, yeah, he needs to go out and go it alone with a role that's tailored to his strengths. And it's out there, but I don't think it's in Uncharted.
Okay. So if you fancy looking at Uncharted and galleons and Tom Holland hanging off a plane, it is out this Friday at cinemas. Go and enjoy it. Before we go, what's the film of the week, Neil, for you?
We liked Marry Me more than we thought we were going to, but I think the film of the week is Flea.
Jack?
Yeah, I agree completely. I think the other two are definitely fun movies, but Flea's an important one and one well worth seeking out.
Okay, I haven't seen Flea, but it's my movie of the week to go and see this week. But if I'm just choosing on the ones I have seen, it's going to be Death on the Nile, because of all the champagne in the Nile. Okay, before we go, it's time for a reader's question. And here we go. This one ties in nicely to the film, one of the films we've seen this week. What's your favourite movie wedding? Jack.
Mine's a recent pick, Palm Springs, the comedy with Andy Samberg. And they replay the wedding over and over again, and it gradually kind of gets weirder and weirder. It's a Groundhog Day wedding, but I think that movie's so funny, and really love Andy Samberg. So yeah, that's my pick.
I think the one that Dustin Hoffman gate crashes in The Graduate. But if you're talking classic weddings, the entire first act of The Godfather is set at a wedding, and I think that's also a pretty impressive one as well.
Mm-hmm. Mine would be Bridesmaids, because it's all about a wedding and the fallout of women planning a wedding and the weird passive aggressive things that happen between bridesmaids. But also I just love that at the end they do get the wedding and they sing Wilson Phillips, and you know they're going to be friends for life and it's all going to be fine. Love that one. So that would be mine. Quick reminder then, before we go, that the current issue is on sale now. What's on the cover, Jack?
Batman.
Do go out and buy it. Loads of great stuff in there, including a feature by Mr. Neil Smith, right?
Yes, I got to chat with the art director, Terry Acland Snow, who's a fascinating fellow who's had a hand in some classic films, Barry Lyndon, Aliens, Batman. He's had a really interesting career, and it's a really fun feature to write.
He created the Batmobile. Who wouldn't want to read about that? So please go and find that on shelf, in store, right now. That's all we have time for, so it's time to say goodbye. Do you want to say it in the style of a passenger on the SS Carnac?
I think I'll just say... au revoir, mes amis.
Okay, Jack.
Goodbye!
That's what she would say. That's what she would have said. And it's goodbye from me. I'm just doing it in the style of somebody who has a proper English accent, which no one in this film does. Hey. So goodbye from all of us, and we'll be back next week.
and enough champagne to fill the Nile.
Hey, little sister, what have you done? Hey, little sister, who's the only one? Hey, little sister, who's your Superman? Hey, little sister, who's the one you want? Hey, little sister, shotgun. It's a nice day to start again. It's a nice day for a white wedding. It's a nice day to start again.